Hey, friends, welcome to another week of the Joanna Whaley podcast. I'm so glad you joined us today. If you are an LGBTQ person or an ally looking for spiritual support, we have an awesome avenue and a community that we are building through this podcast. If you go to patreon.com/Joanna Whaley, you can join a whole bunch of other LGBTQ people who are also interested in faith. There's chats, there's direct message features, there's lots of additional content that you don't just get from listening to the podcast. And you can subscribe for as little as $4.99 a month or $9.99 a month if you're a little bit of a music nerd and you want to get some more behind the scenes. Go to patreon.com/Joanna Whaley and join the community today. We would love to see you there. We're going to get started right now in our new series called Healing After. Well, hello, everyone. Today is going to be really different. I'm telling you, this is going to be a really different podcast for the next 4 weeks. Usually I come in with a guest podcast that I want you to hear, or coming this spring and summer, you're going to hear some interviews with people for the first portion of the show. But guess what? You are stuck with me for the next 45 minutes. Yep, 45, I promise. I have hard cuts on this podcast. You will not have to sit here for 2 hours because I don't want to talk that long, first of all. But the other way, I'd like to keep this podcast to 45 minutes. Wherever you're watching this, if you're sitting in a boardroom, or if you're driving to work, you can just listen to this whole thing on the whole drive if you have a 45-minute drive. If not, find a way to listen to it. Anyways, I'm excited about this week's podcast because it is the beginning of what is called my capstone project, or kind of like a master's thesis, if you will. If you didn't know this, if you're new to the podcast, as I'm recording this, I am currently a seminary student at Wartburg Theological Seminary in Dubuque, Iowa. Go Orange. Okay. I have fallen in love with my new school. And I'm really excited about this project I'm going to bring to you today. This 4 week series is called Healing After. And here's why I really think it's important that we get into some of this stuff today. You know, I grew up Catholic. I grew up in a Catholic church where I was, I was kind of brought up in the Gregorian chants. And as a kid, it was kind of boring to me and I wasn't really that excited about it. My grandma and my grandpa were really involved in ministry. My grandfather was a choir director. My grandma was a hospital Eucharist minister, which makes sense now that I'm going into hospital chaplaincy, and is really going to make a lot of sense as I get into some of these things. But as a young Catholic kid, I had this internal gender struggle happening inside of me. I had this really hard time understanding that inside of me was Joanna, but the world saw a boy. And I was wrestling with it. Yep, if you're listening or watching to this, I am a transgender woman. And I'm also a Christian. And that is a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their head around. But as I was growing up in this church, I remember distinctly there was a trans woman or a gender fluid person involved in my Catholic parish. And what I did not know was in the background. What I saw as a young kid is I saw a trans person who looked a little bit like I didn't totally identify with how this person, you know, looked and all this, but I understood it inside of me because I wanted to do girly things. But what I didn't know, because I just saw this person serving communion on Sunday, what I didn't know is that there was this huge holy war going on in the background. And my mother was fighting this battle on the church parish council. I wasn't aware as a young person wrestling with gender dysphoria, and also interested in this thing called faith, that my faith system wasn't going to accept me. You see, from the years 1450 to like 1800, there was so many laws happening within the world against homosexuality. In 1533, throughout Europe, there was these laws against sodomy. Before Henry VIII broke with the Roman Catholic tradition, sodomy became the civil offense under what was known as the Buggery Act. And it eventually came under Catholic ecclesiastical law. But I didn't know this as a young person. In 1553, Mary I, who was Henry VIII's daughter, was seated as the ruler of England. And she restored Catholicism and repealed the Buggery Act. There was so much changing happening within the world at this time. But the Catholic Church continued to enforce this heteronormative activity in the world. You see, for so long, you go to 1451, there was papal inquisitions. Anyone who was caught committing sin, the sin of sodomy, and they were put to death. From at least the 5th century, the Roman Catholic Church, and I'm not picking on Catholics. I grew up Catholic. We've come a long way. But the Roman Catholic Church in that time, in the 5th century, they deemed any forms of sexual activity outside of procreation and marriage as unnatural. And it became this fallout for same-sex relationships. There was this huge fallout within the Christian world, within the world as we know it. The Catholic Church deemed any sexual activity outside of procreation as wrong and sinful. And this became the norm. It became the norm in the church. And the Catholic Church in this time, and still today, was a powerful force. And when the state really established it, these ideas became normal to oppress and to ask those who were LGBTQ in that time to conform to the Catholic and the church's rule of law. See, in 700s, the punishments for sexual sin became even more grotesque over the years. Men caught being effeminate and being with other males, they were forced to fast for 10 years. Yeah, or an effeminate male fornicating with anyone else, they had to serve 10 years of penance, 4 years of fasting, and up to 4 years of fasting or 15 years of fasting. Can you imagine? This was the world. This was the religious rule of the day. Forcing LGBTQ people to comply or starve or face the punishments. In the 17th century, the invention of the Gutenberg press came along in this time of the world. And there began to be some erotic works, if you will, in the world being printed. And they were written by men. And there is in these publications, people who were queer in these publications. But inside of them, because of the church's intense opposition to the queer community in that time, these publications began to mock the church. And they began to arouse the anger of Christian leaders. And in 1432, because of all of this going on, there became this increased call for a crackdown by the church. That anyone caught in public or found to be a sodomite, it became law to find them and to put them to death. There was this council created in this time called the Office of the Night. And from 1432 until 1502, listen to this, they incriminated over 17,000 men of same-sex acts. In the fallout of the Spanish Inquisition, the Catholic Church set out harsh counsels. And they would look for breaches in canon law, specifically those who were practicing same-sex acts or any infraction that led away from the orthodoxy of the Catholic Church. The church was learning in this time to seek out LGBTQ people and to stamp them out from existence. Compliance was how we held people to account. Compliance. It was the only way to keep people in line at this time was fear. Be straight or be dead. This was the message that the church early on. You look at 15th, 16th, 17th century. This was the message the church was communicating to the world. The Catholic doctrine in this time, it was the official religious teaching supported by the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith that many officials had been quoted and stated that the Roman Catholic belief was that the Catholic Church condemns homosexuality. And any statements about transgender people in that time, which it was, you know, was really just called like effeminate at that time. It was in these areas that any gender variance, any sniff of homosexuality were against the Catholic doctrine. And these things had to be dealt with. This is the reality. This is the reality that we have had in our past in the church. And I'm speaking to you today as a Christian. I can't imagine being a transgender Christian in this time. Being a transgender Christian in the world today, I'm recording this in 2024. Whenever you listen to this, being a transgender Christian now is a challenge. But to think that my church, my place of worship, would use my Jesus to sanction my death because of who I am or who I love, it's unfathomable. And it is something that we deal with today on a small scale. But this is our history. This is our history. This is where we have come from in the church. The church has a dark, sad history of taking the LGBTQ community and trying to stamp them out. When we come back from the break, we are going to dive in deeper into some of this history and some of what I've experienced and where we're at today when it comes to gender and sexual variance in the church. We'll be back right after this. If you're like me, it can be hard to find an LGBTQ community of faith. Well, we are building that right now at patreon.com/JoannaWhaley. You can connect with other LGBTQ people and allies who also are interested in faith and spiritual things. Right now, for just $4.99 a month, you can join a community of other LGBTQ people who also are serious about faith and spirituality. For just $4.99 a month, we can talk through direct message. We can have Zoom calls. I can basically be your pastor online. And you don't have to go to a church to be re-traumatized if that has been you. Just go to patreon.com/JoannaWhaley.com. Again, patreon.com/JoannaWhaley. We'll see you there. So before the break, we were talking about the history of where the church came from. As I said, I grew up Catholic and I was living my life, and I felt this variance in my own life and in my own body. But I didn't know. I was unaware of the history and the deep, dark history that this church, this denomination I worshipped in, held. I didn't know any of that. So let's come a little bit closer to now. I want to look to 1979, Pope John Paul II. I remember I was a Catholic. I was a good acting Catholic as a child. My grandma always joked with me when I left the Catholic Church. She said, there's always a pew for you here. But I remember John Paul. Remember John Paul II, 1979, the liberation theology movement was really on the forefront of trying to free LGBTQ people from the oppression of the church. And it was in this time, in the late 70s, early 80s, that Pope John Paul II made this distinction that the correlation between liberation theology was in bed with Marxism. Now, Marxism is a big buzzword in Christianity. If you, some of you may be rolling your eyes right now because you've heard that term used, and people are always like, what does that even mean? Like, what are we even talking about here? In 1883, the writings of Karl Marx discuss the ideas of human freedom and liberation from oppression and marginalization. So when you hear it's Marxist, what we're talking about in this context is liberating oppressed people. And the church sometimes has a really hard time with liberation because the Marxist ideas were so demonized by the highest levels of church leadership at certain points in history. In recent years, though, the Roman Catholic Church has been attempting to dip its toe into gender theory. However, mischaracterized, here's what I'm going to say. However, there are mischaracterizations in it. There are misses here. But I have to say, I have been watching the Catholic Church reckon with its difficult past, and I see its current Pope right now really making strides. As I said, sometimes mischaracterized, sometimes it doesn't quite hit the mark, but the Catholic Church is trying to make moves to show up in the world today in the right way. And for that, I celebrate. My whole life, I wrestled with this gender thing. I didn't know what it was. When I was a kid, we didn't have language for trans. I remember my mom asking me, are you gay? And at the time, I didn't, I'm like, no, I don't think I'm gay. I don't, at that time, I didn't know I liked boys, of course, but like, I didn't know. So I said, no, I'm not gay. I'm sorry, Mom. I just liked stealing your clothes and wearing them in the house when you're all asleep. That was the wrestling we dealt with. But I didn't understand at the time how much my mother was trying to support me. A mom that was on the church parish council fighting for the rights of a trans person. I had no idea what was going on behind the scenes. You know, parents who exercise what psychologists call empathetic immersion actually have shown that they can increase an empathetic culture in their household for their children. It shows positive mental health outcomes. I took this course in my undergrad called book banning, super fun class. I was an independent study, took it with a professor. And I studied in the Philadelphia Inquirer. They ran this article in 2023 where there were these two Florida moms that were just battling the book banning brigade in Florida. And in 67 school districts, listen to this, 67 school districts, there were moms of LGBTQ children advocating, protesting, and fighting for their kids' rights to exist and to see themselves in the story. And in almost each and every one of those 67 school districts, there was protests on the outside, mostly Christian protests. A 2016 Burns survey revealed that some of the most traumatic experiences that LGBTQ people have comes from rejection of family, bullying, and coercion to stay in the closet. And most of those ideologies stem from religious ideas. In 1999, the United States, for the first time, allowed two gay dads to appear on a child's birth certificate in the state of California. In 2015, the U.S. Ruled in favor of marriage equality. And it was eventually, it was adopted in all 50 states. Although, still today, religious adoption agencies can refuse to and exclude LGBTQ people from these adoptions. This is all stuff that if you look at some of the biggest opposition against human rights, against LGBTQ rights, it's coming from Christianity. I started attending after I left the Catholic Church. I told you my grandma told me, come on back. I started attending this mega church, really cool mega church. Lights and sound and lions and tigers and bears, oh my. Fog machines and drums and sound systems at 110 decibels. It was like a concert every week. It was awesome. I loved it. And I had experiences with God there. I really did. And, sometimes you could hear LGBTQ people talk about their experiences in church. And sometimes I don't have a lot of good things to say. I mean, for good reason, right? But I had great experiences. I did experience a God in these places. And I thought that this was a loving place. I believed I would hear, like, we love everybody. We want you to be authentic. We want you to be real. We want you to bare your soul before us. We want you to confess your deepest, darkest secrets and sin. And we will love you no matter what. Until I started taking that promise seriously within a church. I started telling my pastors and my friends that I struggled with my gender. And I was on staff now at this point. I was working. I was a pastor in this church. And I started saying, I've never felt like a man. I always felt like a woman on the inside. And I don't know what to do about it. And that was the first time I was sent to conversion therapy. I am a three-time conversion therapy survivor. According to Kyle Heinrich Ulrich, in the theory, there's this theory of yearning. Someone with a feminine nature trapped in a man's body was yearning for sex. This is what they would say. His theories came from this portrayal of the god Uranus. And in his opinion, even though they were unpopular, he was imprisoned for rumors of his own sexuality. There's a lot of misconceptions and wrong ideas about what gender is and what sexuality is and where it comes from. In 1899, German psychiatrist Albert von Schirach, I'm not going to pronounce his name right. Just have some grace for me. He created this hypothesis that he could cure homosexuality. Oh boy, isn't this starting to sound like something we're aware of happening today? This was one of the first onsets of conversion therapy in 1899. These ideas stem from the concepts of psychodynamic theory. And many modern psychologists and therapists have, and it is studied over and over, that psychodynamic theory is not an appropriate theory for understanding why someone is queer. However, this is a concept that was grabbed on by Christianity. Christianity really held on to these ideas of psychodynamic theory, of the idea that homosexuality was a choice and it could be cured, that it was a sin disease. And conversion therapy took hold, and the church practiced it widely. In 1999, Brazil became the first country in the world to ban these practices of conversion therapy. They said, you are no longer allowed to do this. But some of these practices in conversion therapy really were traumatizing, and the damage had been done. Despite a lot of modern tropes of homosexuality and gender variant people as mentally ill, believe it or not, in 1973, the World Health Organization and the American Psychiatric Association deemed that gender dysphoria and homosexuality were no longer going to be considered mental illnesses. And that's when we began to see these medical systems in Europe and America begin to drop conversion therapy practices. This is important. But Christianity has held onto them. Christianity has held on to theories that the scientists, that those who study these things, have deemed inappropriate. When we come back from the break, we are really going to dive even deeper in. This is a deep dive. We're drinking from the fire hose today. Stick with me. Take a lap if you need a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more theories that have been debunked. I don't know if you have noticed, but all of the music on this podcast is my own. I write and record all of my own music. And now, if you're a nerd like me and I love music things and want to know about what's going on with music and understand the inner workings and backgrounds of what musicians are doing, you can go to patreon.com/JoannaWhaley, and for $9.99 a month, if you select the higher membership, you can get all of the background and all of the demos and everything that I am working on for all my music. And also, you'll be a part of that LGBTQ community and their allies who are also interested in faith. For $9.99 a month, go to patreon.com/JoannaWhaley. Once again, it's patreon.com/JoannaWhaley. See you soon. Well, welcome back. Before the break, was really starting to dive into some of these practices that have been debunked. And what I want to do in the next few moments is really focus in on the separation of science and the church's belief on certain things. So I started to talk about psychodynamic theory. Conversion therapy has its roots in Freud's concept, in Sigmund Freud's concept of psychodynamic theory. Psychodynamic theory is strongly influencing and is a strong influence in psychology, especially in early psychology. But it is treated with skepticism today. First of all, let's look at Freud. Freud relied heavily on his own self-analysis to base his theories. Secondly, his patients represented a very narrow spectrum of society. His clients were mostly affluent Victorian-era Austrian women, meaning that Freud didn't even study a wide range and diverse pool of individuals. The third criticism of psychodynamic theory. The third criticism is that traditional psychoanalysis has minimal therapeutic value to people who are less talkative, less psychologically minded, or maybe they just have mentally disturbed. And these theories can be abused in these ways, and they were abused in many ways. These therapy models that drove therapists over the years and mental health providers over the years, but these models really, and here's where conversion therapy really finds its way into its own category of messed up, and I'm a victim of it 3 times. But what conversion therapy does is it says, here's the goal. We want you to be straight, and we want you to be cisgender. Okay? If we can both agree on that, let's do this. Any therapists in the room are cringing right now, because that is terrible therapy practice. Good therapy says, let's talk, and let's lead you to be the best version of you can be. That's good therapy practice. But conversion therapy says, I, the therapist, am going to lead you where I think you need to be. That is the basis of conversion therapy. It is destructive. It is harmful. It puts people in prison in their own minds. If you want to go back, I detail my conversion therapy in a couple episodes on this podcast, and I will again. But I was a prisoner in my own mind because I was working towards the goals that I was told I was supposed to be. And it wasn't healthy for me. These desired Christian goals were harmful to my health because they were denying my very identity as a human being. I was told that I had to fit a certain mold in order to be loved by God. If not, you would burn in hell. That was the concept. Do this or perish. I was taught not to trust myself. I was told that my gender and my sexuality was my, quote, flesh. It was my flesh. I had to deny my flesh, end quote. There's this really nasty thing that happens in conversion therapy practices and also is kind of prevalent in some Christian theologies that really encourages people to get married quickly because of sexual immorality. Using the scripture that says, you know, you should not, husbands and wives should not abstain from sex for too long as they will be tempted. But this is abused in these types of ideas to say, in order to be sexually pure, you need to get married and start having sex. And I was sold a lie in a bill of goods that said, if I get married and start having sex, all my problems will go away. And it just wasn't reality. I was really struck by part of the Augsburg confession that when it says, since our priests wanted to avoid open scandals, they married wives and taught that it was lawful to enter into marriage because the temptation of sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife. It is better to marry than to be aflame with passion. First of all, it's really unfair to women to just get married so that you're not horny. It's a bad reason to get married. But it is a common practice that ministers and Christian men are taught, especially in ex-gay conversion therapy practices. This is a rampant teaching, and it's still prevalent today. It still goes on. No matter how many laws get passed, these things are still being taught as theology. These ideas to keep us from becoming queer are taught as theological practices. When I was working in a church, and I thought that working in a church would make it safe for me. You know, so I started to go underground. I thought when I was my third round of conversion therapy, I thought going back to work in a church, I had been away from a paid staff position in a church. I thought that the pressure of the pulpit would keep me straight. Because in my second round of conversion therapy, it was about being taught how terrible it would be to lose my influence. So I thought if I went and gained influence again, that it would keep me straight. But it didn't work. Yeah, this is part of what goes on in conversion therapy. It says, you know what? They tell you, take risks for the kingdom instead of taking risks that you might get caught doing something you shouldn't be doing. Or they would say, what you need to do is step into higher levels of leadership so that the pressure is higher to stay pure. These are the things we're taught. Theologically, we're taught these things. Until one day, I got called into the pastor's office after a staff meeting. And I was sitting across from him, and he asked me point blank, it's been brought to our attention that you are considering a gender transition. Is this true? And I said, yes. And one of the questions they asked was, why didn't you come to us sooner with this? The reality is that there was vague, in some churches, very vague language around what they believe when it comes to LGBTQ issues. And because of the social conditioning happening around us, I felt that I couldn't come out because I was reading the room. I was reading everyone around me, seeing that, okay, well, the majority of the church says this, but there's no written policies. Ambiguity actually breeded harm for me in this experience. So I had to seek spiritual counsel in private while I was in the closet. This was before I got fired. I was talking to pastors of affirming churches. But I had to do it in private because it wasn't safe. It wasn't safe to speak out loud. I mean, this is why kids are afraid to come out in their schools, because it isn't safe. There are pastors right now preaching in pulpits who are gay, but don't feel safe to talk to anyone. There are people who have been harmed by the continued rhetoric of their church about how they're going to burn in hell if they are honest about what is going on inside of them. This is the reality. The church has inflicted a lot of harm on the LGBTQ community. So where do I want to go? What do we do? I feel like I dumped a lot of just really heavy stuff on you today. Where is this all going, Joanna? Where are you going with this? Well, as part of this four-week series, it's my hope and prayer to see something change in the world and to really work towards a better world. Last winter, I got invited by somebody in my church who is the director of spiritual care at the University of Michigan. We're having a conversation after church one week, and she says, "You really would like this, and I think you would be good at being a chaplain." So I entered into chaplaincy. I entered into this thing called CPE, or Clinical Pastoral Education, and I just fell in love with spiritual care in hospital setting and mental health settings. But I started to see and interact with a lot of LGBTQ patients who were harmed by church. And I started getting a lot of referrals as a chaplain in this hospital, as a trans woman. I started talking to person after person who had been harmed by church and who never, ever went back. And my mind starts thinking and ticking. What if this person could come see the chaplain when they're not in the hospital? What if this person could seek out spiritual care through their therapist? What if their therapist, who saw a spiritual trauma, referred them to a chaplain and they could receive spiritual care without needing to go to a church again to be traumatized? Maybe they'll go back to a church again, but maybe they won't. So what I want to do over the next few weeks is I want to explore what would it look like to offer chaplain care, spiritual care to the LGBTQ community long term. Not as a supplement to therapy, but something additional too. So I want to thank you for joining me today. So I'm going to leave you today. Next week, we're going to dive into some really awesome stuff. Stick with me over this series. It's going to be an awesome time. Again, go join me on Patreon. Join this community. We're kind of building it through the podcast. But now we're talking about how do we make it institutional through this. Go to patreon.com/Joanna Whaley. We'll see you next week. Thank you for joining me this week. Have a good one.